This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
The coronavirus crisis has forced a lot of churches to close their doors, but that isn't turning people away from religion. In fact, there's evidence it's having the opposite effect. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew.
That's absolutely right. As the coronavirus spreads around the nation, there's churches are being closed down. Now you're looking at like the holy day season, days of Passover, days of unleavened bread, and places around the nation and the world aren't holding services. But that isn't necessarily pushing people away from interest in God or religion. In fact, they had a fascinating survey by McLaughlin and Associates that looked at 1,000 likely American voters and found that 5% of them believe that coronavirus and the resulting economic meltdown associated with it were signs that God is judging America. Another 17% believed that it was a wake-up call for us to turn back to faith in God. And another 22% believed that both of those above statements were true. It's both a sign of judgment and a wake-up call. So altogether, that's 44% of those polled who believe that God is using coronavirus to send America a message. And so if that if McLaughlin and Associates did that survey well, and it truly is representative of likely American voters, then that's like 67 million Americans who believe that God is using coronavirus to send a message. And only about half of Americans are registered voters. So if you could double that, that could be 120, 130 million people who are seriously looking at this and thinking that, well, God's trying to say something. And the poll also went through and it found a few other interesting questions, just kind of as to like people's beliefs and how they're responding to this. They actually found that 29% of poll respondents believe that the coronavirus was a sign that we're living in what the Bible calls the last days. So again, that's another, or that's 44 million likely voters who believe we're in the last days, up to 80 or 90 million if the non-voters act same as the voters. But also that about 40% of Christians were listening to online sermons, searching for information about Bible prophecy, and reading their Bibles more often. That same statistic was true for actually 22% of America's non-Christians, or I guess that would be like secular Americans. It even found that about 6% of agnostics polled admitted to praying to a God they weren't even sure existed. To stop the virus. So it does actually reveal something interesting just about how people operate, in that when times are good and you're going about your daily schedule, it is just easy to become interested in your daily schedule. But then as soon as a crisis or something like this happens, you do get this this kickback interest in religion. They saw a similar thing, didn't last for very long after the September 11th terrorist attacks, right, in 2001 for, I don't know, for 2 or 3 or 4, maybe 5 weeks.
Yeah.
The churches were packed, but then by about a month after that, by into October, things were pretty well back to normal.
Yeah, we're seeing a similar kind of bump in interest among Trumpet readership and viewership. We actually had our editor-in-chief put out a letter to coworkers this week, and he talked about just how much this has boosted the traffic to our websites. He said that February and March each set all-time records by large margins. He said since the end of January, we've seen a 132% increase in new users compared to last year, 233% increase in traffic from search engines. And so you definitely see something like this happens. A lot of people are, they're searching for answers, and it's natural for people to look to God or try to find out, well, what does God have to do with all of this? Or is there something that I need to be doing differently? Which is a very encouraging sign in a lot of ways. It seems like there's a whole lot in the Bible that shows that God does use crises in order to get people's attention.
Right, and it seems like natural disasters or disease epidemics are these. There is kind of an element to those types of crises that it's not something that it's definitely not something that another nation did to you. This is like powers of nature, God's world that just really does get people's attention. Actually, even secular sources like that. I mean, the Wall Street Journal is talking about the potential of a coronavirus great awakening, and they made the point in there that they're like in past eras this thing may have been more common, but since science has become powerful in the last couple hundred years, it's like we've been able to chain up a lot of these forces of nature. Natural disasters aren't as devastating as they used to be because of better infrastructure. Diseases aren't as devastating as they used to be because of better medical facilities. But when something like this finally does break free of those constraints, and they phrase it like the monster gets loose, then you do see an uptick in people interested in religion. And that's actually, or at least the Bible strongly indicates that would have happened in the end time. There's a prophecy that our editor-in-chief, Mitchell Gerald Flory's drawn quite a bit of attention to in his book, Great Again. It's a prophecy from Amos 7 about this is about like God's prophet going and delivering a warning message to the leader of the land, a leader typed by the ancient king Jeroboam the second. But there's like this confrontation between God's prophet and a false minister. And then in the ancient times, Jeroboam preferred the advice of the false minister, and the nation of Israel fell into ruin shortly after that, which definitely gives us a strong warning for today, is that a natural disaster or a disease epidemic like coronavirus can kick off the religious revival. But when you start getting a resurgent interest in religion, you do start hearing a variety of different ideas from different sources.
Right.
Like I said, this is like one of those ideas in the mix, is God's actual message from God's actual prophet. But then you have a bunch of messages for false prophets. Actually, you go through like the Revelation 6, Daniel 24, like four horsemen of apocalypse. I mean, pestilence is one of those horses. Religious deception is another one of those horses. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they ride together, where the pestilence gets people's attention, and then the religious deception pulls people away. So it can be quite confusing for all these people Googling about Bible prophecy, and then you're seeing everything from blood moons to the Mayan apocalypse to thetrumpet.com.
Mm-hmm.
But our founder of the Plain Truth magazine, Herbert W. Armstrong, was always famous for saying, "Is like, don't believe me, don't believe anything I tell you, just believe your Bible, believe God, believe your Bible," and then provided resources to help people go through actual Bible study, filtering out what does the Bible actually say, and what is just things that people think the Bible says because they've heard that they've heard it from preachers who aren't quoting scripture to back up their points.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And it seems to me the coverage that we've had on the Trumpet, the latest Trumpet edition, the articles that we have in there, this is the May-June 2020 edition, really do show how actively God has been involved in all of this. You see prophecy after prophecy being fulfilled. We're going to talk about a couple more later on today's program, but it does show a significant contrast to the message that so many of these other preachers are out there saying. You have ministers actively saying that this has nothing to do with God trying to bring us to repentance. We don't have anything really to repent of. We're doing just fine. This is just nature kind of playing a game on with us. And but yeah, the true message of the Bible is definitely one that cuts through a lot of nonsense and gives people real direction in how to respond to this. Andrew's written an article about this trend, Will Coronavirus Trigger a Religious Revival in America? You can find that on the front page of the Trumpet. We'll also put a link to our article, You Can Survive the Coronapocalypse, that talks about how God is trying to direct us to repent and the steps that we individually need to take in response to the crisis that is rolling throughout the world. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. Moving on, with the coronavirus ravaging economies all over the world, governments are scrambling to prevent economic collapse. But of course, all these measures are going to come with long-term costs. This week, European leaders put together a massive joint relief package. To learn about this, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, I think in Europe's case, it was leaders scrambling to not look like idiots. This was a massive face-saving exercise on behalf of the European Union. There are all of these headlines saying, you know, they can't get their act together. Italy asked for help. No one, everybody refused. They had to go to China. So there was just this real pressure on Europe to actually agree on something. So that's what they did. Finally, after many hours of grueling discussion, they agreed on something. What they put their names to is a half a trillion bailout package in the headlines. In paper, on once that's actually delivered, it is probably going to be just a tiny fraction of that. So this is something, like I said, it's a face-saving exercise in Europe. And all of the difficult questions that we talked about last week were, for the most part, kicked down the road. So the big question is just, well, Italy's debt is unsustainable. Their debt is being pushed much higher at the same time that their economy is being destroyed. If Italy goes down, that starts bringing the rest of the Eurozone down with it. What do we do about that? And that fundamental question still hasn't been answered. What they came up with in this deal is a bit of repackaging of things that have already been announced, and then also they did finally agree, okay, Italy can have some be loaned some money that they can only use to deal directly with the healthcare crisis, but there won't be strings attached to that. There won't be European bureaucrats and German and Dutch bureaucrats coming with that money to oversee exactly how that money is spent. So that was the compromise, but the reality really is that it was a step for Europe. It is a step towards a shared pool of debt, which is probably the next big bar that Europe needs to overcome to be a super state. So it was an important step, but nowhere near the final destination. There's still a lot that the EU has to get figured out now in terms of how to not have the whole thing fall apart every time there's a crisis.
So one of the big points that we've been talking about in the economic problems that Europe is facing in Italy is that this really shows just how deficient the current structures are and how much this highlights the need for more robust leadership with more powerful tools to be able to deal with something like this. Is that really what you're taking away from, say, this bailout?
Yes. I mean, there was at one point a marathon 14-hour meeting. And I don't think they agreed anything at that. They had to come away. They had to come back again. I think this is showing people very clearly that the way the European Union right now is working isn't working. It's not fit for purpose at the moment. And so, yeah, so I think it's pushing them in the direction of a super state. It was a step towards there. But it also just shows that if they're going to keep this thing alive and if they're going to keep the euro going, it needs a lot more. And that this crisis, it's exactly the same that we saw with the euro crisis. They always did the absolute bare minimum necessary to deal with each particular stage of the crisis, kicking the can down the road, refusing to take those big decisions, but taking the bare minimum steps towards a super state as they could get away with. But all of that just stores up a bigger catastrophe for the future.
So this weekend, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has a Key of David program airing. You can find it on thetrumpet.com, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire. He talks specifically about how much these circumstances are paving the way or opening the door for exactly the kind of super state that you're talking about here. Prophecy says another resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire is on the doorstep, and we can see how these kinds of crisis conditions really could make that a reality.
Yes, absolutely. I think what this week's news shows us is that we're on that path. They're moving incrementally towards that destination. They were through the euro crisis as well. They're absolutely not willing to just say, okay, let's let the euro fall apart. It's not worth it. Let's give up and go home. So they're on that path. But at the same time, it also, they're not there yet. It's still going to that. And they haven't solved the crisis. I think that's the big thing to take away. This half a trillion isn't, that's it. Problem solved. The European Union is going to keep functioning the way that it is. It's not that at all. It's still building towards a crisis. Italy's debt is still completely unsustainable. European decision-making still takes way too long. So all of these different aspects that Mr. Fleury was talking about contributing to a crisis, you need to be more unified to not have economic crisis. We need a smaller European Union. We can't have these 20-something members of the Eurozone. We can't have all of these members having to sit down and make decisions in these committee meetings that take hours. We need 10 nations or a smaller group of nations. This whole democratic leadership where all one small nation's parliament, sorry, the Netherlands, but relatively small nation's parliament holds up the entire thing. We need something that's more like a strongman. We need something more autocratic. You can see that the current status quo isn't working. It's causing a crisis. And at the same time, you can see that crisis is pushing Europe exactly the way that the Bible forecasts. And one of the things that Mr. Fleury brought out in that Key of David, and one of the things that stood out to me just even writing on this subject for the Trumpet print, is that this is exciting to watch. Just how specific, there are so many specific Bible prophecies, and God has revealed so many specifics about what Europe is going to look like. And then you can go back and look at what Mr. Armstrong wrote and made some very specific forecasts based on that revealed truth. And then we see Europe moving in exactly that direction. These crises pushing Europe in exactly the direction the Bible forecasts. And so, this isn't something that's just of interest for those that are into European macroeconomic policy. This is the Bible being proved true before our eyes. This is the formation of a super state that's going to change the world. But ultimately, it's about seeing Bible prophecy fulfilled as Europe takes these steps. It can be a painful process at times because they don't seem to take these steps until they're really forced to. Mm-hmm. But you can see a tentative outline of the future of Europe just heading right into exactly what the Bible forecasts.
I would encourage everyone to watch that program from Gerald Fleury, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire. It's up on thetrumpet.com right now. So definitely go check that out. This is really very likely one of the most important outcomes of this coronavirus crisis, what it does to reshape Europe. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Iraq has a new prime minister. The trouble is, this is the third prime minister the nation has had so far this year. But his appointment does underscore the direction that Iraq is going. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
So this man, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, he was designated by the president to go ahead and try and become more than just the candidate for the prime minister. There's been a few of them this year, and he looks like he's got the best possible chance of becoming solidly the prime minister that will hopefully lead Iraq into some new elections. But what's interesting about the choice of this man, he was the former director of their spy agency. He was very critical in the fight against the Islamic State that has pretty much ended inside Iraq. And he is seen largely as a candidate that everyone can kind of agree on. And by everyone, I mean the United States and Iran. They are, it seems, the two parties that you have to satisfy to then become a prime minister. Of course, the main player that you need to satisfy is Iran. The reason that the previous prime minister designate got removed from office is because Iran holds power over a large segment of the parliament inside Iraq. We've talked about how these Shiite militias that belong to Iran operate inside Iraq. They were used against the fight of with the Islamic State, and then they became fully fledged parts of the Iraqi military. And then they became fully fledged political parties as well. And now inside the parliament that then must confirm these prime ministers, they form the largest party. So you've got an Iranian bloc inside the Iraqi parliament that forms the largest party. The former designate that got ousted this Thursday, he was not in favor of the PMF or these militias. And so these militias would not vote for him. And so he was removed. And this man seems like he is a compromise candidate that is acceptable for Iran. And we know that because the Quds Force leader, the new Quds Force leader that replaced Qasem Soleimani, was in Iraq over the past couple of weeks. And he signed off on this man becoming the next prime minister. And so if you get the Quds Force leader, Iranian Quds Force leader, saying that, okay, you've got our go-ahead, most likely you will be able to become the prime minister inside Iraq.
So this definitely seems to highlight just how powerful Iran is in Iraqi politics. What's interesting about this man as well, this third prime ministerial candidate, he seems to enjoy more public support, more popular support within Iraq than the two men who preceded him.
Yeah, so you can understand this very much so, because he isn't considered a pro-Iranian candidate per se, because he isn't necessarily affiliated with Iran, with the Shiite militias, and with another military faction. He is largely seen as impartial. And indeed, the Iranians, while they like this man more than they like the previous one, he's definitely not a pro-Iranian figure, this prime minister designate. So he is considered a more central, let's say a more balanced prime minister, rather than being in the bed of Iran. The reason for this is because the people of Iraq are still protesting. They are protesting against Iranian entrenchment. And so the prime minister that the people would accept can't be seen to be an Iranian stooge. So the question is, why did Iran allow this man? Why are they backing this man to be prime minister if he isn't the best candidate for Iran? Probably two reasons. One is that they recognize that Iraq has not been able to go forward for a while because of these protests, and they need a prime minister. And so maybe he's not the best guy, but he's definitely not against us, so maybe we can work with him. They also recognize that when it comes to the levers of power in Iraq, they already hold it. They already hold it by having the majority inside the Iraqi parliament. They control the Iraqi parliament, even if they don't control entirely every movement of the prime minister. So that's one. They have the parliament anyway. And the second reason is they have probably discussed this, discussed with this leader that in the upcoming summit with the United States that's due to take place with Secretary of State Pompeo in June or July, that's going to go over economic and strategic interests between the two, between the U.S. and Iran. He has probably agreed to discussing how to get American forces out. How to get American forces out of Iraq. Mm-hmm. This is something that is going to come to the forefront. The U.S. is trying to look at getting out of Iraq, and this man seems to be tasked with the job of doing that. And that's probably why the Iraqis are the Iranians are probably satisfied with his candidacy for the moment. We know that that is going to happen. We are writing every second week, it seems, at thedrumpet.com about how the United States is removing its forces slowly but surely out of Iraq, and in the end, Iran is going to gobble up that nation. That's what we wrote when Soleimani was killed in our article after Soleimani. That's what Rowan Reich wrote last week. And that's what our editor-in-chief has written for 30 years, going back to his book about the King of the South. We expect an Iranian takeover of Iraq with the removal of U.S. forces. And this candidate seems like, even though he's not 100% pro-Iran, Iran's happy to have him there because he'll probably be the one that negotiates that exit.
Pretty fascinating. We'll look forward to more coverage on that on thetrumpet.com. In the meantime, we'll put links to that article by Warren Reinsch in the show notes. Anything else that you would send people to for more context?
Yeah, very much. Go ahead and read The King of the South by our editor-in-chief. It will give you the biblical prophecy that provides the background that helps us say that Iran is going to take over Iraq.
Very good. Thank you very much, Brent. During the time of coronavirus, there are a lot of concerns about the loss of civil liberties, threats like arbitrary detention, unsafe health practices. So if you're the number one international organization given the job of policing these issues around the globe, who should you turn to keep tabs on them? Well, the United Nations is making an extremely odd choice. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this news actually happened last week on April 1st, but it was not an April Fool's joke. But the People's Republic of China really was appointed to an extremely influential United Nations Human Rights Council panel. So this panel, it's made up of just five member nations, and they're responsible for selecting 17 different individuals to operate as basically human rights mandate holders. These are positions such as an investigator who oversees arbitrary detention in countries around the world. One of them you could call kind of a freedom of speech czar, overseeing just that people around the world are able to speak freely. One of them is a health practices investigator. One is an individual who oversees government-orchestrated disappearances. So China will now be one of just five countries in charge of filling all of these human rights offices that are supposed to maintain a certain level of humanity for the peoples of the world, or at least blow the whistle when there are violations so that the other nations can know about governments that are kind of abusing their populations. So for anyone who knows even the slightest bit about the People's Republic of China and the Communist Party that runs it, this appointment is just, you know, it would be laughable if it weren't so tragic, because the Chinese Communist Party is the world's number one abuser of human rights if you go by the number of people suffering under their barbaric and just utterly abusive leadership. This government is the king of arbitrary detention, you know, the king of the emperor of government orchestrated disappearances and of absolute restriction on freedom of speech, deplorable health practices, which we've learned a lot more about just recently with the Wuhan coronavirus. So for the UN to put China on this panel, where it'll be able to stack the deck with people who it has either bribed or coerced into staying silent about China's egregious practices, it really is a miscarriage of justice and logic and reason. Hillel Neuer is the executive director of UN Watch, and I think he really summed it up pretty aptly. He said, quote, "For the UN to allow China's oppressive government a key role in selecting individuals who shape international human rights standards would be like making a pyromaniac into the town fire chief." So I think that conveys it well, because this appointment is just about as absurd as it could get.
The UN seems to have a knack for these kinds of appointments that almost read like Onion headlines or Babylon Bee headlines.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, as shocking as this news was, in some ways it wasn't shocking at all, because they do have a track record of appointing pyromaniacs to be the, you know, the town fire chief. In 2007, Iran, the country that's actually openly boasted about deceiving the world regarding its nuclear weapons development, that country was made vice chairman of a UN disarmament commission. You know, that's the same Iran that is the world's number one sponsor of terrorism. So that was just unbridled lunacy. That same year, the UN was on a roll that year. That same year, they appointed Zimbabwe to be on the chair for the Commission of Sustainable Development. And that appointment of Zimbabwe came just a couple of months before Zimbabwe's famous hyperinflation crisis. That's when they started printing $100 trillion banknotes. That's a one with 14 zeros. But within weeks of being printed, those bills were worth virtually nothing. And they appointed that country to be over this panel that's supposed to tell the world how to be economically strong. You know, and then 2017, the UN appointed Saudi Arabia to its Women's Rights Commission. That's one of the worst places on earth to be a woman. They're treated barely better than livestock. They can't go anywhere without a male guardian, including to the police, where they would tell them about abuse from their male guardian. You know, that country was put on, you know, the Women's Rights Commission. So the list of outlandish UN appointments could go on and on, because this organization is just racked to every rung by corruption and ineptitude.
If you're looking for evidence of man's inability to rule over man, this is about as vivid of an example as you could find.
It is, yes. The UN has been just a massive failure, and its largest failure is that it has not accomplished its number one stated purpose, which is keeping the peace. You know, since the UN's inception in 1945, there have been more than 270 wars and over 3,000 other military conflicts. Almost as many people have died in all that, all of those conflicts, as died in World War II itself. And there is one analyst, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, who actually saw from the start that the UN would be not just a failure at peacekeeping, but actually a catalyst to conflict. Mr. Armstrong attended the first meeting of the UN back in 1945, just as World War II was coming to an end. And he said, quote, "Already I see the clouds of World War III gathering at this conference. I do not see peace being germinated here, but the seeds of the next war." So Mr. Armstrong understood that the UN would not and could not bring peace to the world, because he studied God's word. He studied the Bible, and the Bible contains numerous passages explaining that mankind can't bring peace to himself. One of the most salient of those is Romans 3:17, which says, "And the way of peace have they not known." So this decision to appoint China to the Human Rights Council panel, it shows that man does not know the way of peace. It shows that the UN has descended from a failure to a farce. And it shows that Mr. Armstrong's analysis all those years ago was, it was exactly right.
Well, we actually have a chapter in our booklet, He Was Right, called Peacekeeping Undone, UN Done. And you can find that on thetrumpet.com under our literature tab. We'll also put a link to that in the show notes. And Jeremiah has an article up there now, China Joining Human Rights Panel Reveals UN's Absurdity. Go check that out as well. And thank you for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about how what's happening with coronavirus should be a wake-up call for nations to brace themselves for bioterrorism. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In the last month, we've witnessed a virus with very low mortality rate completely grind the world to a halt. It's done more damage than 9/11 or any terrorist attack ever could, and yet you'd have to think that terrorists who are interested in destroying the world are paying close attention and taking good notes, and some are warning that we'd better brace ourselves. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, as you say, this has certainly alerted many forecasters to the potential threat of biological warfare, where such a pandemic that we see spreading across the globe, such as coronavirus, is actually given on purpose or produced inside a lab and then released or targeted at an enemy. And so just this past week, there was three or four major articles in different newspapers, mostly opinion pieces, but just making these connections that look what Corona has done to the economies of the world. Look how it's shut many, you know, everything down. What happens if it was something that was far worse and something that was created inside a lab? And of course, we have spoken and looked at biological weapons, biological in the past, biological weapons have been used. There has been a bit of a, for let's go say about 100 years, biological weapons have not been used in a mass warfare sense by, ever since World War One, by a Western power. And they have been deemed largely something that we shouldn't want to use, and they're so grotesque we shouldn't use them. Of course, there have been some rogue powers that have used certain biological weapons. But it does bring to mind the question, are biological weapons being able to be used now? Can terrorists get their hands on them? And will they be deployed in the future? And a number of articles came out. One was at Israel Hayom by Eric Mandel. He writes in a number of newspapers, and he said pandemic should be a wake-up call to prepare for bioterrorism. And he's saying that we're just not prepared. Coronavirus has shown that we're not prepared for such an outbreak. Another one was down in the Australian. Biological war is now the top of the mind. And a couple of things about biological weapons. People haven't been too concerned about them in the past because one, well, the main reason is because they normally affect your population. It's hard to contain them. If you let a biological weapon out, it may come back to get you. That is one of the reasons why they haven't been used. And we'll speak to why that isn't necessarily a valid excuse, a valid reason of why they won't be used in the future in a second. But also right now, over the past few years, we do have the development of technology that can you can actually target certain genetic types with certain biological weapons. They might, let's say if you wanted to attack the United States, or you would go after somebody that you would use a biological weapon that attacks a certain Caucasian genetic makeup rather than other ethnicities. And so China is at the forefront apparently of researching how these bioweapons can be genetically targeted to certain populations, which would then invalidate that reason of why they haven't been used for so long, because they might get it themselves.
You said it would be a mistake to assume that because a virus may hurt the individuals who put it together, that they wouldn't actually use that form of terrorism.
Right. So you have that, the element that we are getting technology to the point that you can target certain genomes with these biological weapons. But then you have to look at some of the players that have secret, well, let's say not so secret, biological weapons programs. And we know that China has one. We know that Russia has one. We know that North Korea has one. And we know that Iran has one, particularly as well. They are actively working on biological weapons. And when you talk about the fanatical regime of Iran, that has proven beyond doubt that it's willing to sacrifice its own people in wars in the past. And we know that their messianic ideology, it allows for their own countries to simultaneously combust with the rest of the world, and that's all that is necessary for their 12th Imam to reappear. We know that they aren't deterred by the what other powers might be of this biological weapon harming themselves. And so this is a worry going forward, not just the terrorist element, but that state actors could use a biological weapon equally as transmissive as corona and yet far more devastating upon a population. We know the book of Revelation talks about plagues, pestilences coming and knocking out massive portions of humanity. It doesn't say that those are all the result of a human being eating a bat. Perhaps that is also the result of biological warfare as well.
just looking at what the world has done in response to this virus, it truly is shocking. And I would think any bad actors who are watching what's happening and they're determined to try to inflict as much damage as they can in whatever way they can, they have to recognize that there is a whole lot here to work with. If you have a virus that is really in so many ways as minor as the one that we're dealing with, and governments that are going to such lengths to try to prevent it from spreading to the point where they're shutting down their economies, you'd have to think that a deadlier virus with if it was just as transmissible as COVID-19 but had a higher morbidity rate, that it would just be absolutely devastating. There definitely has to be terrorists and groups that are trying to inflict as much damage as they can that are taking good notes on what is happening here. We do have an article up on the website from Tim Ostendorp that is specifically about the possibility that this virus was actually a test tube creation on the part of China. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. Brent, do you have anything else that you would point people to if they wanted more information about this?
Yeah, well, I think this could be a worry that people would have for sure. And so I think it would be a good idea for everyone to go and read our article. It's up, Coronavirus, How Should You Respond? Because that can really show people that they need not fear on a personal level something like this. And it shows them what they can do to receive the protection that God is willing to afford people if they respond to him.
Thank you very much for that, Brent. Bioterrorism may get worse in the future, but France had a reminder this week that the standard garden variety kind of terrorism is still a concern. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, an Islamic terrorist killed 2 and wounded 5 in a stabbing attack in the French town of Romans-sur-Isère. That's a town a bit south of Lyon in southeastern France. On April 5th, the police arrested him and 2 others in connection with the attack. He was a Sudanese asylum seeker. In his late 30s, he'd come to France in 2017. He reportedly shouted Allahu Akbar as he went through several shops in broad daylight with a knife, just kind of stabbing all that he could find. The authorities have said it would have been much worse, but the corona lockdown saved lives. There were just, the shops were just much, much emptier than they would have been. So you've got now this reminder of terrorism at a time where you've got the coronavirus. And I think it does point to tensions that could come to the fore as we start to deal with the aftermath of coronavirus. I think right now, everybody's still focused on corona. I think in France, this particular headline still didn't make a huge amount of news. But once the immediate crisis moves on and people kind of pick themselves up and dust themselves off and start to look at the masses of debt that they've accumulated and think about, well, how do we rebuild our economies, our healthcare systems? I think migration is going to be right up at the top of the controversial issues in the European Union once again. How we're in masses of debt, we're trying to recover from this. Why are we spending money on hundreds of thousands of asylum seekers that are coming here from other countries when they're just bringing terrorists and those that are more dangerous into our countries already? And you see this particular individual, again, a fairly recent asylum seeker who's come into Europe since the migration crisis. I think we see that a bit already here in the UK. I've seen some people saying, I don't know how true that it is, I'm just illustrating the tensions, but some people saying things like, oh, well, I bet that the police are out arresting ordinary people on Friday because they don't want to be around the mosques, where I bet they're letting the Muslims all kind of get together and have their services while we're closing down Easter Friday services. And Easter will be shut. I bet by the time it gets to Ramadan in a month, it will all be open. Like I said, I don't know if that's true, but it points just to the fact that when the chips are down, people look at themselves and look to themselves and their own much more. And so I think when you see these terrorist attacks, there's the potential for an even more draconian European response as this crisis kind of continues.
Yeah, that's a very good point. As you were speaking, I was just thinking about the fact that we were talking about all of these protests that were happening worldwide, so much unrest, so many disruptions taking place in so many nations, and all of that, it's almost like it was frozen and just checked overnight, and it's been none of those problems have gone away, but you're just not seeing those problems out in the open because this other issue has just swamped everyone's whole perspective. But as soon as this begins to unfreeze, then you're going to start to see those same kinds of problems exacerbated. And I think you make a great point that you could see the difficulties associated with recovery from coronavirus actually exacerbating some of those. And this tension between Europeans and the migrants who have come in, you could definitely see that being even worse than it was before once all of this begins to get moving again.
I think you're seeing some of this again already in southern Italy, where this is one of the worst hit places by the crisis, and it's a hotspot for European migration. Some of these charities, so-called, that rescue migrants, they're kind of getting back to work, rescuing migrants, dropping them off in southern Italy. And now you're getting these Italian residents, you know, saying, well, what in the world? I'm struggling to feed my family. I don't know where the next meal is coming from. And now we've got all of these migrants coming in. So it is making this, potentially making this crisis much worse. And I think this is where this story ties into what we were talking about in the first half, you know, that Europe is for... it's being pushed together by these crises, that you've got crises driving Europe in the direction forecast in the Bible. And all of those trends that we talked about, you know, the Bible talking about there being a strong authoritarian leader in Europe. Even we didn't talk about it then, but there's a lot of prophecies in the Bible that talk about Europe being much more religious and emphasizing that Christian identity more. And Europe getting involved in the Middle East. You know, Brent talked about some of those prophecies about Iran and radical Islam being the king of the South, and Europe is forecast to be the one, or prophesied to be the one, that confronts them. And so you can see how this could then develop as another crisis after the coronavirus, or just keep developing this terrorism and migration. And that's just going to keep pushing Europe in that same direction to become that kind of more authoritarian, religious power that's getting much more involved abroad.
Well, we do have an article up on the website, Jihadist Kills Two in France, about this specific story Richard was talking about, and you can go check that out on thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much for that, Richard. More evidence that China is using this coronavirus panic as cover to increase its aggression in the South China Sea. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, a Chinese Coast Guard ship rammed and sunk a Vietnamese fishing vessel a few days ago. This happened in a disputed section of the South China Sea, and the Chinese took the crew of this Vietnamese boat. There were 8 crewmen, and they detained them for close to a day, but they did end up later releasing the crew. But this whole thing happened near the Paracel Islands, on a part of the island chain that is well within waters that legally belong to Vietnam. It's inside of Vietnam's exclusive economic zone, or its EEZ. And international law makes clear that a country has exclusive rights to its EEZ, but China cares about as much for international law on EEZs as it cares for international law on human rights, as we talked about in the first half. So instead of complying with this law, China disregards it and says Vietnam was trespassing in our waters, because China does claim these waters, just like it claims almost the entirety of the South China Sea. So basically, China just says, we were only defending our turf by sinking this, but the reality is just the opposite. And this, it really is just some truly belligerent behavior on display by China here.
You want to just put this in the context of what else China has been doing to take control over that geography?
Sure, yeah. You mentioned how a lot of this is happening while the coronavirus, you know, pandemic is spreading. And a lot of the world right now is just reeling from that. And you would think that there may be some reflection, possibly even some solidarity on the part of the nations to cooperate with each other. But with some of the aggressors, just the opposite is happening. They're not only continuing some of their aggressive actions, but they're kind of using the cover of the pandemic to ramp those things up. And of course, China is a big one. since the pandemic started, China has also built some new research stations at some of its military bases on the artificial islands that it's built in the South China Sea. It has also landed aircraft on one of those, the one at Fiery Cross Reef. China has also ramped up its antagonism of Taiwan quite a bit as well, up at the north end of the South China Sea. And we've seen China invade Taiwan's airspace a couple of times. We also saw it ram a Taiwanese Coast Guard ship. So this incident with Vietnam sinking their fishing boat there, it's just one small part of the aggressive push that we've seen from China in the last couple of months under the cover of this coronavirus to just kind of assert more dominance and more control over the South China Sea and other parts of its periphery.
We do have an article up on the Trumpet site. China sinks Vietnamese fishing boat as its drive to control South China Sea intensifies. We'll link to that, as well as Gerald Fleury's article, China is Steering the World Toward War, in the show notes for today's program. And thank you, Jeremiah. We'll finish by looking at the explosion of unemployment in the United States, a problem that comes with several ugly side effects. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, in the first half, we talked quite a bit about just people re-examining their religious beliefs due to the pandemic and its associated economic meltdown. And so now, here towards the end of the program, I've just got some statistics just highlighting how severe that meltdown is shaping up to be, especially in regards to mass unemployment. In the United States, 6.6 million people filed for unemployment during the last week in March. That's twice as many as filed for unemployment the week before, and 30 times as many as filed unemployment during the corresponding week last year. So huge spike. Actually, they said if you look at the last 2 weeks in March, that's 10 million Americans filed for unemployment, bringing the total number of the unemployed, or the Wall Street Journal is predicting that the total number of unemployed will soon reach 30%, highest as it's been since the Great Depression. So when you're looking at this economic crisis, this is nowhere in the realm of what the Great Recession of 2008 was. This is a Great Depression style severity. Now, I guess the difference is we'll see how long this lasts, where obviously because the Great Depression was financially driven, it got down to 30% unemployment, and then they struggled to get out of that hole for the next decade, to where this, the rebound could be very quick once the disease is contained. But it does highlight, I think it's a really good point, and just highlighting how fragile the world's economic systems are. I mean, before this coronavirus, I mean, there was definitely those, including thetrumpet.com, warning that debt and things like that were going to lead to an economic collapse, and that's definitely all true. But then you're having, you can have people argue back and forth over how resilient the U.S. economy is, but then something like completely almost non-economic related is someone in Wuhan, China gets sick, and that sickness spreads across the world, and it's done, at least in terms of its severity, as much damage as the Great Depression, as far as how deep the unemployment's got. Now, as far as how long it's going to stay there, it'll be, I'm sure, much, much shorter than the Great Depression was. But
right. Although it's hard to tell how long some of these residual effects may last, how many of these businesses that have been hit may never recover, and how there are certain sectors of the economy that it seems may well have been dealt irrecoverable blows from this. You would hope that that things would get back to some semblance of normality here in the coming months, but at this point, it's just very, very difficult to say. We have quite an excellent article up on thetrumpet.com right now, Coronavirus Feeds Mass Unemployment, and it talks about a couple of prophecies that Herbert W. Armstrong highlighted over a period of decades about the United States and economic collapse in this country. And whether this specific instance feeds directly to that, it's hard to say, although some of the debt that the United States is incurring could well have long-lasting effects on the nation as well. We will see. We will all stay tuned. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Benjamin Franklin: search others for their virtues, thyself for thy vices. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.